Hello again and welcome to All You Ever Wanted to Know. I'm Scott Fitzsimmons, and it's that time of the month. It's time to talk with Heart to Heart with David Distie. How are you doing today, David?
I'm doing well. How are you, Scott?
Good. It's great to be here today, and you've got a very special guest on the phone with us. Tell us about your guest.
So, yeah, on the phone with us today, we have Randy Flood, who is the director of the Men's Center, which is in Grand Rapids, and he's also the co-author of two books, Masculopathy and Stop Hurting the Woman You Love. So he's done a lot of groundbreaking work on working with men on issues of abuse, sexual addiction, lots of great work on things that are specific to men. Mm-hmm. So welcome, Randy. Thanks for coming on air with us today.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, David, for having me.
So tell me a little bit about the Men's Resource Center. How did it get founded? What do you guys do there?
Well, we founded it in 2000. And with my co-author, Charlie Donaldson, and he had a center out in Holland, Michigan, and I currently operate the one in Michigan, Grand Rapids, Michigan. And it's a center that specializes in psychological counseling services for men. And we see men as a special population. They have a unique experience growing up in society, similar to how you would have a center for Hispanics or a center for women. We see men having unique challenges growing up in what we sometimes see some of the toxicity of male socialization, which we'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot of groups, and we believe that men working in groups with other men who have similar problems or even diversity amongst them, that talking about their feelings, talking about their issues and struggles, relationship struggles, is a way for them to not feel so alone, feel support, feel accountability, and make more substantive changes more readily.
Excellent. And so for our listeners, how can they get a hold of the Men's Resource Center? How can they find out about the resources that you have available?
Yeah, www.menscenter.org, menscenter.org. And there's a listed and description of all of our services that we offer in person. Obviously, the listeners probably won't be able to travel to us, but we do offer intensives where people do travel to us and stay at a downtown motel, and we spend 6 to 8 hours a day with them, depending how much time they want to spend with us. But we also have phone coaching and counseling that they can also connect with us via Skype or phone for consultation.
Excellent. So, yeah, on that website, there's lots of great resources there, and also they can do the Skype counseling, telephone counseling over the phone. So lots of great stuff they can access through you guys. Good.
Yeah.
You've written two books, Masculopathy and Stop Hurting the Woman You Love. So let's start off with Masculopathy. What is Masculopathy?
Well, it's a mouthful, and the subtitle is Understanding and Healing the Malaise of American Manhood. We've been working for decades on examining male socialization and how we believe that society tends to raise men into half their humanity for them to achieve the pinnacle of masculinity. And so we see the 21st century masculinity being more balanced, more relational, more emotionally intelligent, and the more 20th century, 19th century masculinity that we were developing boys into manhood is not preparing men for the demands and the fitness that they need for the 21st century. And so in our discussions with people, a lot of times they thought we were being anti-male because we were critiquing masculinity and using, kind of deconstructing masculinity. So we decided that we were talking about a problem with no name. So we decided to name it and talk about the pathology of masculinity, this errant masculinity, this unbalanced masculinity that doesn't allow young boys and men to live into their full potential and their full humanity. And so we came up with the term, and then we came up with categories of different topologies and scope and severity, and we spell it out in our book and talk about how we treat it with men and helping them work on their relationship skills and emotional intelligences and empathy, compassion. And when they do that, surprisingly, they don't lose their masculinity. which sometimes was the other critique, that we were emasculating men, and actually that doesn't happen. They come with their F-150s, Ford trucks, and they leave with them, and they don't want to, you know, it's not as though we emasculate them. We just help them develop and cross-train themselves, and they maintain their masculine attributes, but they also develop softer human qualities that we often associated with the feminine historically.
Okay. So, I guess, how do you go around about developing that those softer qualities that are needed in men these days?
Well, we do it from two ends. We have the counseling services, which I said is bringing guys into group, and then we also have prevention services where we go into the schools, like for 7th, 8th graders, and we also do some stuff on college campuses where we talk about healthy masculinity and ways to keep boys connected to their heart and helping them develop safe and healthy relationships. But in our groups, I think what happens is that men historically haven't been the primary consumers of mental health services, because there's so much about being a man is about not asking for help. It's about being able to take care of problems on your own, being able to fix things, and you don't ask to for a hand up. You pull yourself up by your bootstraps, as they say. And so part of what we do is we try to get men together and begin to revision masculinity and begin to talk about how it isn't weakness to ask for help, that that's a sign of wisdom and courage to be able to reach out and be vulnerable and talk about our struggles and issues. And a lot of men struggle feeling like they're the only one who are struggling with their issues and struggling with their masculinity and not feeling man enough, feeling weak or inadequate. So when you get men together and they begin to talk about some of their struggles, it decreases their shame and sense of marginalization that comes from this high standard of masculinity. And just that process of being together helps humanize them and helps reduce shame, helps them reconnect with others. And that group work that we do is the way in which men are given permission to talk about issues and talk about vulnerable feelings and not feel that they're losing their manhood by doing it.
Mm-hmm. That's powerful. Reducing that shame. That seems like one of the big things that might drive masculopathy is the fear and the shame that I'm not going to measure up. And if I open up, then other people are going to know that I'm not enough.
Right. We don't give permission in our culture for men to talk about their pain. And so what happens is we talk about in masculopathy is that because of that weak self-concept and feeling that they're not man enough, a lot of people, to prove their masculinity, will use power and control and aggression and violence and binge drinking and driving fast cars and playing hyper-competitive sports. And, you know, and they do all these things to try to prove their masculinity because deep down they feel inadequate. And the problem with that is that you're only as a man for a day, and then tomorrow you got to get up and you got to keep proving it. Mm-hmm. And so it sets up men to act out their pain rather than talk about their pain. And the more we give men permission to feel feelings and share emotions and share struggles, the less they're apt to act it out into society, into relationships.
Okay. So you mentioned a weak self-concept. Can you dig into that a little bit more? And what's its opposite? What's a strong self-concept?
Well, a weak self, what I was referring to earlier is that high bar that we put for men that's unrealistic. In that, yeah, there are some men that achieve it, and we call them a man's man, but most everyday guys are not super athletic, are not super successful, don't have a large wallet, don't drive all the fast cars and big trucks. So most guys can struggle with that weak self-concept. And so what we want men to feel is to not have that sense of value coming from these rigid views of what a man can be. Mm. So that, say, for example, in school, if a boy discovers that he's not athletic, and then he discovers he's got great musical talent, or he's really good at drama, or he's really good at art, that we could encourage that young man into his talents, into his gifts, and that we can still prize him as having a form of masculinity. Mm-hmm. That it's not he's not being a girl, he's not being gay, he's not being weak, he's not being inferior, he's being himself, and that can be part of the diversity of masculinities. Mm-hmm. And so we even work toward trying to pluralize that. Rather than saying masculinity, let's call it masculinities, because there's different ways we can manifest our gifts and our individuality, and it doesn't mean we have to all try to have fit into this narrow box that constricts a large part of people's humanity, trying to fit into that narrow view. So that's how we build a more healthy self-concept for men, is when we give them permission to be who they really are and not denounce their masculinity because they're not fitting into that traditional box.
Randy, Scott Fitzsimmons here. I was just going to say, is this something you notice in a certain age of men? Because I know that you're ringing a lot of bells in my mind, and, you know, I've never been one to be shy away from, you know, my emotions or the softer side, if you will. But I also definitely see the places where, you know, there's that drive to be more masculine, or, you know, even I'm raising two boys now, and I'm starting to realize how much, you know, some of these desires are fleeting in my older years, and how, you know, seeing, you know, obviously my kids have maybe some athletic ability, I start to see that, and it's kind of neat. But then I'm also starting to see some of the musical ability or the intellect coming out, and I'm starting to realize that, you know what, I think I'd almost rather them, if they wanted to go into music or other things, it seems to last a lot longer in your life, or you know what I mean? Because as I'm, you know, just cracking 40, you know, the sporting aspects of things or playing them is it's still there, but it's right. Different, and I'm starting to maybe grasp some of these things a little differently.
Right. Yeah, and I can say, Scott, that I, as a father, even though I was the director of the Men's Resource Center, I wrote a piece in Voicemail Magazine, and it got published in short stories about my relationship with my son. So I was this director of the Men's Resource Center that's supposed to be prizing all this diversity and masculinity, and my son was a three-star athlete.
Yep.
And, you know, I gave him pitching lessons, and he played football, basketball, baseball, and then all of a sudden his freshman year, he tells me he wants to quit playing baseball and try out for the musical.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? you're really good at pitching. I've invested a lot of money into your arm, and that's my favorite sport. And if you're really good at baseball, you don't do musicals. Musicals are for the people who don't know how to play baseball. I mean,
yeah.
That was how embedded those belief systems are in us. And so I could intellectually say one thing, but then when I was challenged as a father, it really cut against that grain. And so then what happened the following year is he quit basketball so he could try out for the chorus here locally in Grand Rapids, the community theater.
Hmm.
And he got a part playing in Greece.
Yeah.
And so then he hung on to football, which ironically, here he is moving toward, you know, taking ballet lessons and learning how to sing and dance and play the piano, and he's playing football. And he was the starting tight end for the state championship East Grand Rapids Pioneers.
Oh, nice.
And caught a touchdown in the fifth overtime.
Wow.
Longest football game in high school history in Michigan, anyway. So my point is that, yes, it is important and ultimately best for our children to develop a variety of skills.
Mm-hmm.
And again, not to attach so much of our masculine identity into, you know, being human. I mean, it's mm-hmm. being human and be diverse. And like you said, you can carry playing the piano a lot further into your life than you can throwing and catching mm-hmm. a football.
and you can combine it into different aspects of your life. I'm starting to see different ways where, you know, these skills can carry into many different things, whereas, like you said, you know, football is one time of the year, and I love football, by the way, so, that, you know, this is not
getting
football, but it's one of those things that those skills don't necessarily carry on throughout the regular part of the year. You know, there are maybe other football or other skills or sports or things like that. But yeah, I'm trying to see the ways that that we can increase those different aspects in our kids too.
Mm-hmm. Seems almost like the opposite of weak self-concept isn't a strong self-concept, but more of a broadened self-concept.
Yeah,
a broadened definition of what it means to be a man.
Or, you know, the other one I like to use is a grounded and balanced self-concept, you know? So, like, if someone taunts you about your masculinity or about who you are, and you don't get reactive to it, and you don't have a shame attack and kind of start questioning, am I good enough? Am I lovable? Who I am? Is it valuable? Then that means you're grounded into who you are, and other people can't push you over, per se, and make you feel inadequate. And that's what we want to really work with, helping our boys develop as a grounded self-concept. And it still is very hard to do, even though it's 2017. There's still a lot of pressures on boys, and they get shamed by being called a fag, gay, girly, mama's boy, to anytime they show soft human qualities, and that's associated with the feminine or being a gay male. And then young boys don't want to be labeled as such, and so then they begin to shut down that part of themselves and then try to stay into this more constricted way of living. And it's not healthy.
You're listening to All You Ever Wanted to Know. It is Heart to Heart with David Disty, and we're talking with Randy Flood, and we are going to be back with more of Heart to Heart on All You Ever Wanted to Know. We're back here on All You Ever Wanted to Know. Scott Fitzsimmons here with David Disty. It is Heart to Heart, and on the phone with us once again, Randy Flood. Tell us again about Randy.
So Randy Flood is the director of the Men's Resource Center, which is out in Grand Rapids, and he's also the co-author of two books, Stop Hurting the Woman You Love, Breaking the Cycle of Abusive Behavior, and his newer book, Masculopathy, Understanding and Healing the Malaise of American Manhood. So it's great to be talking with Randy Flood and his depth of knowledge about issues facing men. And like his book, Masculopathy, it's hard to say that word, Masculopathy says, the malaise of American manhood, or Canadian manhood too. So before the break, we were talking about a weak self-concept and how we can broaden the definition of what it means to be masculine, what it means to be a man. There's a couple other factors that you talk about in your book as well. Can you just tell us what those are?
Yeah, the other concepts we talk about that's part of the pathology of masculinity that we call masculopathy is inadequate emotionality. And that's the difficulty with experiencing, naming, managing, and expressing and governing feelings, leading to some behavioral instability and shallow and or conflictive relationships. And another way to understand it is emotional illiteracy. We again see historically that emotions belong to women. Women are emotional. They wear them on their sleeves. It makes them weak. And so traditionally we've raised men to shut down emotions and not feel sad, don't cry, don't feel fear, don't feel anxiety or insecurity. And so there's a lot of pressure on young men to not feel these vulnerable feelings. And so the only feeling that you can have as a man and remain manly is anger.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's it. So everything gets kind of transformed into anger. And then the third domain is relational deficits. If we tell men that a real man is a rugged individualist, he's a lone wolf, he's independent, he can fix things on his own, he can be autonomous, then what it does is it teaches men to not want to be vulnerable in intimate relationships. It teaches them to be insular, more on the controlling side, you know, trying to manipulate and manage getting their needs met rather than being able to talk and share space and with equality and connection and intimacy. So that's another piece that we recognize. And then the last domain is when you have men who struggle with a weak self-concept, they have emotional literacy and they can't manage their emotions, and they struggle with relationship dynamics, it puts them at risk of externalizing their feelings, which is an acting out process. Rather than talking about feelings, they act out feelings. And so that's the other piece. And when I first started working postgraduate school, I was working at a forensic practice, working predominantly with people who got in trouble and were on probation, and they got ordered into counseling for domestic violence, drunk driving, sexual acting out. And I sat in the room and ran these classes, and I was looking around, and they were all men. And that's when I first started getting interested in men's work, because back then it was considered forensic psychology, meaning that this is a special psychological niche to work with criminals. And I said, I don't think these guys were born criminals. So I began to ask, what happens to young boys that put them at greater risk of acting out in certain ways and getting themselves in trouble? And that's that externalization process. When you don't give boys permission to talk about what's going on in their lives, the pain and struggles and insecurities and stigmas or whatever it is that they're struggling with, then they're more likely to turn to acting out behaviors and get themselves in trouble with society and relationships and on the job.
When I saw that title of externalization in your book, the first thing that came to my mind was externalizing the cause of things. So saying that these issues are your fault and it's not my fault. So not taking responsibility for, I guess that's still not taking responsibility for your actions. Right. So there's a piece to it of externalizing the cause of what you're doing as well.
Yeah, I think that fits within that category, because when you do have an acting out problem, oftentimes when I work with men who have gotten in trouble with the law, or if you go into a prison system, or if you go into courtrooms, what you notice, the common factor that most of these people struggle with is accountability. Is they tend to believe that they didn't do it, or someone pushed them into doing it, their wife is difficult to deal with, and if you live in my wife too, you'd get mad and you would get frustrated and you'd push and hit too. So there's this crisis in accountability and an inability to engage in self-examination, because that's an internalization process. To be curious about my inner life, my inner world, curious about my emotions, curious about what my value systems are, what creates meaning in my life. That is a reflective, contemplative practice. And externalization, putting boys in action mode all the time and trying to conquer their environment, control their outcomes, manage things that make them feel feelings that they don't want to feel, is all part of that externalization.
So it's a really, all these things are really tied in together. The inadequate emotionality, when you build your ability to notice and feel all the emotions and deal with those emotions, that gives you the ability to not externalize them. And it's tied in with the relational deficits and the self-concept. These aren't four separate things. These are four intertwined things, aren't they?
They are all integrated, and they all play off each other. And again, when we get men to revision masculinity, we help them see a new form of courage and strength. I mean, like you're saying, if you can go inside and discern what I'm feeling and feel those feelings and manage them, not let them run my life, not wallow in them, and then I know how to regulate them, and then they don't come out in these impulses or these aggressive ways or these defensive ways, that is strength. That is fitness, and that's courageous to be able to do that. And so we try to reframe what it means to be strong and courageous and grounded.
And intelligent, too. Like, that's an emotional intelligence, too.
Correct.
Wow. It really transforms all aspects of a person's life when we look at things this way.
Yes, it does.
Wow.
Very empowering when you feel that things are happening to you, and it creates a sense of a loss of control, and then you wonder why men sometimes in domestic relationships have a need for power and control. because intimate relationships are a very unique experience in life, and it's the place where we're going to feel the most vulnerable, because it connects us with emotions. And so if you're not comfortable feeling emotions and feeling vulnerability in an intimate relationship, then you're only going to feel safe by being in control and by having power. And that's what leads to the domestic abuse in extreme and more egregious situations.
So we're kind of naturally flowing into your other book, the first book that you wrote. Well, the earlier book, I don't know if it's the first book or not, but so this other book that you have as well, Stop Hurting the Woman You Love, Breaking the Cycle of Abusive Behavior. So these are things that have kind of led to abusive behavior in intimate relationships. What have you found helps people when they find themselves in these kind of relationships?
Well, what helps people the most is to begin what we call accountability training and insight building, comfortable with self-examination. Because again, if you sit a bunch of men who are still in denial about their issues in a group, and you ask them what caused them to get arrested for domestic violence, let's say it's a group that where they all got arrested, and at the beginning of treatment, most of them will have a narrative that they've been victimized by someone doing something to them that caused them to feel so much anger and so much frustration that they just couldn't help themselves, that they acted out and pushed and hit, and then they got, the police were called, and then they got thrown in jail. And so their story is a very disempowering story, because they really believe they're a victim to someone pushing their buttons. And so it's a crisis of accountability, because we have to teach boys and we have to teach men that we are responsible for our emotions, for our actions, and that no matter what happens in these situations, we have to choose alternatives to violence, alternatives to abuse. And when we start giving ourselves permission to use those tactics to solve complicated human problems, then we're going to be likely pushed into that spot where we will give ourselves permission to act out in an aggressive, abusive way. So it's really about accountability as the first step, and being willing to accept responsibility for our behavior and work on changing.
And so that accountability is the opposite side of the externalization coin. We're really talking about
Correct.
The same issue here.
Right.
So in your book,
I think it's also about our attitudes. You know, for some guys, they have to confront their attitudes toward women. And again, when we tell young men that your soft side of your humanity is considered feminine, and we don't respect the feminine in us, and again, I don't consider it necessarily feminine associated with female. I just consider it soft human emotion or human quality. But we teach boys to disrespect the feminine in themselves, and then they begin projecting that outward to women, and they see themselves, because I'm a man, I'm superior to you as a woman who's inferior. And so it's first an internal process that then later gets projected when they get into relationships with women. So part of sexism and misogyny is it has a psychological underpinning to it, and that's why we treat masculopathy with that inadequate emotionality, weak self-concept, and all that. Because in domestic violence, you have to really work toward changing their view of masculinity, a different relationship with their emotions and their soft humanity, and then helping them readjust their views toward women and develop greater respect and more egalitarian value systems, rather than adhering to a strong patriarchy and hierarchy and control.
So we have accountability as one of the keys for men changing in this area, and empathy is another side of that, or piece to that change, isn't it?
Yeah, because I think the enemy of violence is empathy. If we know what we're doing, and we know the pain we're causing others, and we're connected to our hearts, that inoculates us from acting out and hurting others. And so again, as you can see, the connections that when you teach boys to disconnect from their emotional pain and to ignore it and move toward externalizing it, then it makes it difficult for them to then feel the pain of others.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of all interconnected. And so a lot of times, again, it's not always the case, but in a lot of the clients we work with domestic abuse problems, when we hear their stories in their childhood, they often were experienced some form of abuse or witnessed aggression and violence in their home, which was quite painful for them. But when they talk about it, they talk about it as though it wasn't any big deal. That's just how we grew up. You know, when my dad thought I was afraid of the dark, he taught me a lesson. He took me out in the back 10 acres and dropped me off in the middle of the woods in the dark and made me find my way back home when I was 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I learned how to find my way home and I stopped being afraid of the dark. So I guess it worked. I mean, so they just talk about it very nonchalantly, like, so that's just how it goes. And if I got my police officer father who got mad at me when I cried and he took me and outside by the cul-de-sac and handcuffed me to the mailbox and put a towel around me as I was a baby and let all the neighborhood kids laugh and point fingers at me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, horrendous stories sometimes you hear of the pain that men experience, and then you understand it's often proportionate to the pain they pass on to the ones they love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the difficult parts is that it's not just affecting this one individual, it's passing it on to the next generation and to your partner. Everyone's affected by it.
Yeah, it's often a generational problem to get passed on.
Yeah, well, okay. So there's one part that I found fascinating in your book is the five lies. So can you tell us a little bit about those? What are five lies that lead to abusive behavior?
Well, the five lies are also just about ways in which it points to that male socialization process that we talked about earlier in our discussion. But let me see if I can recall the five lies. I just can't help myself. That's that lie where you feel like someone else is pushing your buttons or I'm being peer pressured. It's that lack of accountability, lack of self-governance, when you believe that and you tell yourself, I just can't help myself. So that's a lie, because we can. There's ways in which we can learn that emotional literacy and behavioral management. And then if I treat her as an equal, then I'll no longer be in control of my life. So again, we talked about that earlier, that guys sometimes don't know how to manage the vulnerability of intimacy. And so treating their partner as an equal feels like they're losing control, because they actually are stepping into greater vulnerability, but it has the opportunity to produce and give them greater intimacy if they're in the right relationship. And again, it takes two for intimacy. The third lie is I have a right to control her, and that comes from the old patriarchal belief system that men are entitled to control women. They used to, be seen as property historically, and with dowries and everything else. And so, I mean, there's still in the fabric of a lot of society is those patriarchal belief systems that I have the right to control her, and we believe that's a lie, and we need to challenge that.
Mm-hmm.
And then two more is if she would change, then everything would be better. Well, most marriages, it's a skills-based relationship, and good marriages require work. But when there's domestic abuse, that's a personal problem. That's like saying to someone who has an alcohol problem, well, if I had a less stressful marriage, I wouldn't be drinking as much. You know, and we don't look at alcohol problems as a relationship problem. We are very clear that it's an individual problem. And I think that that's a lie when we tell ourselves that I will stop being abusive if she changes.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, it's I can still like live like a single man. Sometimes, you know, we want to live more selfishly in man caves, work as much as we want, drink as much as we want, watch as many sports as we want, watch the channels we want to watch. I mean, there's a way in which sometimes we can just get lazy into not working on sharing family life and sharing emotional space and sharing time, resources, and you know, and it's just, you can't live as a single man when you decide to get married. And so just moving out of that paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the five lies that we talked about at the beginning of that book.
Yeah. And it seems to me that these five lies, they affect so many areas. Like, as you're talking about them, I'm thinking about, I hear so many of these with parents. Like, if you just change my child, then everything will be okay. Well, let's look at how you're interacting with your child as well.
Right.
And I have a right to control my child. Well, okay, you have a right to your expectations, but if you use just power and controlling, then is that going to really lead to long-term, the kind of child that you want? Is that what you want? So yeah, a lot of these I find them in parenting, too.
Sure, yeah. And that's, we find that when we work with parents, sometimes they bring the child in, they want us to fix the child because you know, that's the problem. And you know, there are difficult children, and there are children who have difficult temperaments that tend to be a little more rebellious and whatnot. But ultimately, when we choose to be parents, we choose to parent all of our children, and we don't always get all the easy ones. You know, our first son was, you know, was very easy, and we thought we were the greatest parents in the world. We didn't have to, you know, childproof the house. We just told him no, and he looked at us and like, oh, okay. And then we had our second child, and you know, it's like, okay, it's kind of childproof because they were breaking everything, and we were constantly saying no.
Mm-hmm.
It's like there's this of that they like to touch and explore and challenge, and so we had to work with that child differently, and to get into power struggles with those kids and such, and use punitive physical discipline will only just escalate it.
Mm-hmm. That's not going to help the situation.
No.
You're listening to All You Ever Wanted to Know. It is Heart to Heart with David Disty, and we're talking with Randy Flood, and we're going to continue right after this on All You Ever Wanted to Know.
So how much...
We're back here on All You Ever Wanted to Know. It is Heart to Heart with David Disty, and once again, we are on the phone with Randy Flood.
So Randy Flood is the director of the Men's Resource Center, which is in Grand Rapids, and he's got two books that he's co-authored, Stop Hurting the Woman You Love and Masculopathy. So if you're just joining us, go to the Rock website afterwards, and you can find this whole interview there and catch up on what you missed. So just a warning to our listeners, we're going to be talking about some issues that might not be appropriate for younger ears. So if they're around, then do what you need to take care of that.
Maybe guide them in a different direction for the next 10 minutes.
Yeah. So one thing that Randy Flood works with men at the Men's Resource Center is sexual addiction. So Randy, tell us about your work with sexual addiction.
Well, as we talked about earlier in the program, the underpinning of all this is our sense of, you know, masculopathy, which is a pathology of masculinity, which has the four domains of weak self-concept, emotional literacy, relational deficits, with a tendency to kind of act out, externalize. And so we talked earlier about how that can manifest in domestic abuse and controlling behaviors and attitudes of power in intimate relationships, because intimacy is a special relationship that makes us feel vulnerable because emotions are involved. And that can also manifest with men who struggle with intimacy by going toward pornography or seeing sexualizing intimacy and moving into in saying that the only way I can feel connection and closeness to another person is through some kind of sexual act or some kind of sexual objectification. Because again, we teach boys that women have cooties and you don't want to be around women and be their friends and stuff. And then all of a sudden when they turn into adolescents, then we're like, oh, okay, now you're supposed to chase them and you're supposed to like have sexual conquest. And so a lot of times there's this kind of grooming to experience human closeness. The only vehicle that sometimes we give men for human closeness is sexual connections. And that's where the homophobia comes from, where it's like I can be best friends with another male, or I can, you know, have a brother or another person I feel close to that's a male, and if I hug them, then somehow I must have sexual intentions, because you know, if you're a real man, you shake their hand type of thing. And so again, everything can get sexualized, human connection and contact. And so it's no surprise that some men end up having an extreme version of that, which leads to sexual acting out, which leads to using pornography. And what we know about neuroscience is that the seeing sexual imagery changes your brain, and that neurotransmitters are released. You get a rush, you get endorphins kick in and adrenaline, and then there can be dopamine release, which is that feel good pleasure chemical, and then that we call it a process addiction, and that men can get addicted to certain processes to produce that chemical change, and that is what they become addicted to, similar to like gambling. Gambling, you're not swallowing cards and chips. Like alcohol and cocaine, it's a consumption. It's a chemical, truly more something you consume. But process addictions are something you do that creates a change in brain chemistry that you get addicted to.
Mm-hmm.
And so we work with a lot of guys that come in with, in the most common form of it in 21st century, especially with, you know, kids being having access to the smartphones. You hear stories of young men, you know, 9, 10 years old, discovering pornographic images, you know, on the internet. And parents don't have filters. Parents give phones to middle schoolers, and they don't put filters in there, and they get access to pornography, and then the brain gets hooked into this chemical reaction, and then we're seeing quite a problem with people coming with problems with pornography and problems with sexual addiction.
Mm-hmm. And so a lot of this comes back to what we talked to in the first segment is self-concept, inadequate emotionality, relational deficits, externalization. All these things play a role in sexual addiction.
They do. And we work, you know, from an addiction recovery model, we first, just like with alcohol, the first thing you do is you got to stop drinking.
Mm-hmm.
It can't help you with the reasons why you're drinking until you stop drinking. And so I think if someone's truly a sex addict and they have an addictive process on board, the first thing we do is try to work toward relapse prevention and doing things to help them not go into using pornography. And there's lots of things we could talk about and what the strategies we have. But then once they get from what we call sexual sobriety and begin to have intimate sexuality in their life, but not the kind of addictive sex, then we can start getting into ways in which they have relational deficits. A lot of guys are just deathly afraid of intimate sexuality. I mean, we see guys who struggle with erectile dysfunction and potency issues when it comes to intimacy, intimate sexuality, because again, mm-hmm. It connects to your emotions. It connects to your vulnerability, your humanity, your soul, your spirituality. It's a greater, more robust form of sexuality. It's the most evolved sexuality we can have as a human. And so that requires emotional intelligence. That requires intimacy skills. That requires a grounded self-concept.
Mm.
And so, yeah, it all gets connected to that in mental therapy.
So as we build those things, the emotional intelligence particularly, then some of these other issues like erectile dysfunction that you mentioned, they can dissipate, it seems.
Say that last part again, David.
When we build things like emotional intelligence, then it seems like a lot of these other things like erectile dysfunction that you mentioned, they can dissipate if we're able to deal with our emotions
right.
In a better manner.
Right. There's a new word called PIDE, and urologists are dealing with it, and they're prescribing, you know, Viagra to 28-year-olds and 30-year-olds, and what it is porn-induced erectile dysfunction. That's why they call it PIDE.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens is that you start training your brain for these high-potency sexual imagery that's disconnected from human relationships, and it's something you do in kind of your own silo. Then it becomes very difficult to translate sexual experiences, you know, and having everything wired up and being able to do sexuality in a real relationship. And so a lot of young men are struggling with erectile dysfunction. It has nothing to do with their plumbing.
Mm-hmm.
It's having to do with their emotions and relational skills.
Absolutely. For a lot of sex therapy, it's not about, like you said, the plumbing. It's about dealing with anxiety, fear, depression.
Exactly.
It's the emotions that are leading to these difficulties.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's just sad that in our society, we tend to, you know, we have to live in a society, as you know, where we look for a pill to fix everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we have a lot of men who are using, you know, these kind of Viagra type medications when they're dealing truly with an emotional, psychological issue. So there's hope in that we can work on developing ourselves into being able to perform sexually and to be able to be intimate and connected at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So to bring the intimacy back into the sexual relationship, that's the big thing that you're looking for.
Interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. So that's some great stuff. Thank you very much for sharing that information. So once again, where can people go to get more information on all the different things that you work with?
Well, we have our services and the books for sale and lots of blogs and articles on www.menscenter.org, menscenter.org. And we also have another website that we launched that has some more articles and some things we're doing is at the Institute for the Prevention and Treatment of Masculopathy, which is something we haven't talked about yet, but it's basically masculopathy.org, masculopathy.org. And that is another place where you can get some articles, information, some news about some different things we're doing throughout the country. So.
Mm-hmm. And at both those websites, people can get these resources, but also contact you if they want more help. Because again, right. You do telecounseling and Skype counseling as well?
Yep, we do that. And they can purchase packages or just single half-hour consultation sessions just where we'll have a question or something like that, and they can have our devoted attention. And, mm-hmm. So that's available through the websites as well. Or the menscenter.org has the phone coaching Skype. The masculopathy does not.
Okay. But both, definitely any listeners should go to both websites, menscenter.org and masculopathy.org as well.
Correct.
Excellent. Well, thank you again very much, Randy. So again, we've been talking with Randy Flood. He's the director of the Men's Resource Center in Grand Rapids and the co-author of Stop Hurting the Woman You Love and Masculopathy. And it's been great talking with you again, Randy.
It has been good talking to you, David. It's very heartening and hopeful that we are having these kind of conversations about men and masculinity, and
mm-hmm.
and we wish to have to be a part of that conversation with people who are interested like you. So thanks for having me on the show.
All right, no problem.
Once again, this has been All You Ever Wanted to Know, Heart to Heart with David Disty, once again talking today with Randy Flood. That is it for us for today. Thanks so much for being here, David, again, and I look forward to more conversations in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Scott.
Once again, thanks so much for joining us. If you do have any questions, you can always call us here at The Rock at 306-786-ROCK. That's 7625. That is it for us for today. Coming up next, it is the All Request Lunch. Have yourself a wonderful day and be blessed.